Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 137 of Registry Matters. What's up, Larry? Happy Saturday yet again. How are you?
Well, thank you. And we have a full house tonight, I can see.
We do. We have a pretty good crew. And just for a point, I made it so that if you're a patron that you can get into the live stream. I locked it out of just anybody, random drive-bys coming in and listen to it. So that I just wanted to kind of solidify one of the benefits of being a patron is listening and participating in the live stream chat stuff.
That's why we don't. We only have half as many tonight as we have had in the past.
Correct. But I'm just always looking for ways to actually offer up the value of becoming a patron, which we're going to, while we're recording this tonight, there will be a dropout where we're going to go record a Patreon extra. So if you're not a patron and you would like to hear the extra, you should go over to patreon.com/registrymatters and sign up to be a patron for as little as $1 a month. And then you could participate in getting the patron extras that we've been doing lately.
And you get to engage with a couple of quacks before and after the recording.
There would be that, though I think I'm going to outsource my quack to have somebody else represent on my behalf.
Oh, who would that be?
I don't know. I'll have to just find some other quack. Quality caliber of quackery.
You shouldn't have any problem finding a quack of that caliber.
Larry, I got a question. Me and someone inside of the Discord chat, we started talking about term limits for politicians. And I hear people rail against that. Oh, these people have been in there for 20, 30 years, blah, blah, blah. And just to tie this over, someone mentioned on the podcast, on YouTube, that this has gotten too political. And maybe the better term would be too partisan, maybe. But like everything about what we're doing is politics oriented. So I don't want to like throw that we should never talk about politics in general. But sometimes politicians like Mitch McConnell's been there for 1,000 years and Nancy Pelosi's been there for 1,000 years. Chuck Schumer's been there for 1,000 years. Shouldn't we have term limits for Congress if we have term limits for El Presidente?
Well, that's an issue. I think I want to backtrack just a little bit about the podcast because we're not partisan at all here. And it may be perceived that way, but we don't endorse a particular side. I tell you what my political affiliation is, but I bash my side when they're wrong, and I do that with some regularity. I'm about public policy, so I kind of take a little issue with us being partisan. We look at the policies. We're strictly attacking bad public policy. That's the whole point of this podcast. But in terms of the whether there should be term limits, in the literal sense of the word, there are term limits. They are a result of the elections that are held every 2 years, every 4 years, every 6 years, as the case may be. For U.S. senators, it's every 6 years. For U.S. House of Representatives, every 2 years. For most governors, it's every 4 years. And in state legislatures, it's usually some variation between 2 and 4, and a few exceptions, 6 years. But there are those term limitations. What you do when you have, and I've done an evolvement in my thinking as I've aged. I used to feel the same way. I felt that the term limits would be properly, it would be better if we had term limits. And my analysis was flawed at the time. I think I heard someone on one of the news channels talking about people that made a career out of public service. They make bad decisions, but that doesn't mean you want to turn it over to amateurs. He said people who fly commercial airplanes professionally, they make bad decisions, and sometimes we have catastrophic consequences. But that doesn't mean you want to put an amateur in the cockpit, does it?
Nope.
Okay, well, surgeons who are very highly trained, they make mistakes, and sometimes those mistakes are in fact catastrophic. Yep, but that doesn't mean you want an amateur. That doesn't mean you want an amateur as a surgeon. And with what people are referring to as politicians, they prefer to be called a public servant. But in reality, they are politicians. You have to be able to convince at least 50% plus one that you're the best choice of the choices they have. And that requires appealing to people's desires because you're representatives of a group of people. When you have term limitations, I'd like for the person who believes in that to cite me a state where they have them at the state level. Nebraska would be one example where they have them. And tell me that you think Nebraska is so much better governed than any other state, and pick a state that has term limitations where that they can only serve a fixed amount of time. Tell me that you feel that government is so much better because of the term limitations. Because what you have when you do that, particularly at the state level, it wouldn't be as pronounced at the federal level, but at the state level, what you have is you have the unelected bureaucracies that decide what happens. Because when you take a person who's been in just a regular job in a citizen legislature and they decide to run for the legislature because there's a seat open and they have never been in government, but they want to make their first run for public office as a state senator in Nebraska, they don't have any idea how those agencies work. They don't have any idea what the powers of those agencies are. Government is very complicated these days. We deal with issues that were never imagined when the founding fathers developed the idea for this representative republic we have. Nobody was thinking about the Clean Air Act. Nobody was thinking about all the things that we talk that governments at various levels provide today. We're talking about complex things that even I don't understand, and I'm as informed as the average voter and I don't understand all the issues that our state legislators deal with. So what you end up with when you don't have any institutional knowledge, you have the bureaucrats that are making all the decisions. And if that's what you want, that's what you end up with when you have term limitations where you have constant rotation and no institutional memory, no institutional knowledge.
Can you dig into that just a little bit? So you're talking about the bureaucrats would be making the decisions. So can you tell me what is a bureaucrat in that context?
Well, when you contact a state senator in this state who's been around for a while, who's seen various administrations come and go, they know how the Department of Corrections is funding, how it's funded, what its mission is, and what its powers are. When you take the person who's never been in public office before, and they have the best of intentions, I'm not knocking that, but when they come in with no understanding of that institution and what its powers are, what it can do, it's a lot easier to have Regina deciding, and Regina is the lady that we use pejoratively because she works at the Department of Public Safety and she makes all the decisions regarding sex offender registration in New Mexico. You end up with Regina telling, a brand new guppy senator calls and says, well, what's the deal with this? Regina can tell that senator anything she wants.
Okay.
And that senator doesn't know any better. And when Regina says it has to be this way, then that person knows no different. Or you could take it into something to do with child care and protective services. If the person has no institutional knowledge of child protective services, they end up when they say, well, we have to pass this law because this is what's required, because this is the way it's done. You don't understand all of that. And you end up with people who have no institutional knowledge of why things are done the way they're done and what the limitations are. And you end up deferring to a person who's been a career bureaucrat working in the agency, telling you, the elected official, that it has to be this way because they've been there 26 years and you just came on the scene today.
Doesn't that also go the other direction of a politician then getting entrenched in and rubbing elbows with all the big, powerful people, and then they're not necessarily representing the people, but they're representing their donors? And I don't even know if I'm wording that the right way of who would be rubbing the elbows, but just like it seems like that can go in a different direction. Special interest maybe is a better way to word that.
Well, I was going to get to that point that there is absolutely no doubt that a person who's been in office has been in office for a long period of time has a significant advantage over the newcomer, because contrary to what the cynics out there think, people do not come to you and try to offer you money to persuade you to see it their way. What happens is after you've been in office, they have analyzed your voting record, your accessibility, and your receptivity to persuasion in terms of issues, and they end up saying, we like this senator. We don't agree with this senator on everything, but this senator's right 75% of the time when it comes to issues that we support or that we oppose. So you end up, when the newcomer comes in with no public service, they don't have the capacity to raise that money because the special interest, they're going to fund a known versus an unknown. So I can sit back in an office where I work and wait for the checks to come in, and there's no strings attached to the checks. They're just simply looking at what the person has been doing and what they're happy with and how accessible they are, and they make donations. But that doesn't mean we should scrap the whole system. That means we probably ought to take a look at how races are funded.
Right.
Which is a conversation we never get to have in this country, because when you raise any of the options, because of the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United, you can't limit an entity's speech, at least not in federal races. Now, some states do have campaign limits. Ours does have limits in terms of how much you can give in a particular election cycle. But when you start talking about maybe public financing, then people go completely bananas and go into all sorts of convulsions when you talk about that. It's kind of like the gun debate. You can't have a discussion about how to solve this problem. How can we make the races more competitive to take away some of the advantage that the incumbent has without denying the citizens a choice? Now, what you're talking about doing is denying a citizen a choice of someone that they may be very happy to have stay in office. And is that democracy?
Definitely not. Definitely not. I just wanted to get the expert's opinion on it, because I don't think that I can see where the person has the issue with there being people that are there forever, but at the same, you know, the point you brought up about them having understanding of how the system works, Alessandro Ocasio-Cortez, whose name is very difficult to say, brand new, doesn't know how the system works yet. And I use her just to highlight, just because she's probably the most well-known freshman, but she doesn't know how the systems work, where Mitch McConnell knows all the ways to manipulate the system. Is one better than the other one? And not like she needs to get her feet wet and know how the ropes work and so forth. But does she eventually end up in the pockets of the special interest groups? That's where the person's term limit idea would come in. But how do you balance that out? And I think one of the answers would be to have just as much public transparency of where the money comes from and where it goes to. And that's where then the political action campaigns come in, because they don't have to report anything, I don't think, because they're private entities.
Well, they do in this state file reports in terms of who their donors are and who they give money to. But at the federal level, since I'm not working for anyone in the federal system, I don't know what the disclosures, what all is required, but we do have a significant amount of transparency here, and we're always looking for a way to enhance that transparency. But having a government by amateurs, just ask yourself about any other profession. Do you want those professions done by amateurs? And I think you can come to the conclusion, government's a very complicated business. We're not living in the 1780s anymore. we've got issues that are very complex.
I completely understand. Hey, did you see the picture that Super Patron Mike sent us with the FYP compliance tank?
I did. I love it.
I just wanted to make sure that we noticed that. It's in the. It might end up to be. Maybe it'll be the show picture for this week's episode. Anyway. There's a picture of it over in the live stream chat if anybody wants to have a look at the FYP compliance tank. And there's a little subtitle under it. It says, Sheriff's Department, making sure no emails go unregistered. It's a very intimidating device that they could use to make sure that you're compliant with all of your emails.
Well, you're going to comply with registration or else.
Or else. We only have a few news items because we have some other super fun content to cover. But the first one is a homeless man jailed for failing to put address on sex offender registration dies at Rikers. This is from a publication called thecity.nyc. And, you know, I there's a lot of content here, but basically he failed to register. He gets locked up under violation. While he's in jail, he ends up catching the COVIDs and then dies while struggling to breathe, which sounds like an unbelievably terrible way to die. And I think that that is incredibly cruel and unjustified, unconscionable that this has happened.
It is tragic, and we knew that there were going to be will be, continue to be, a lot of people that will lose their lives in correctional settings because of our unwillingness to take a look. The politics would be very bad to release a person like this because he failed to comply with putting his, whatever, the New York is somewhat lenient compared to other states in terms of compliance, but he failed to do whatever those steps were. And we just can't have a person like that out on the street during a pandemic.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And like I said, I just wanted to touch on it just because it's just really terrible.
And then I think the article raised the issue about what sort of medical care he received and whether it was proper.
Yeah, I mean, if he simply died from an asthma attack while laying in bed, that sounds very minimal.
So what it says, in April he tested positive but did not have the virus at the time of his death, according to. So I'm not real clear on the cause of death, but it's still tragic that a regulatory scheme causes you to be jailed during a pandemic.
And then die from all that. Because I, you know, was assuming that on March 4th, he was sent to Rikers. So he did not have the COVIDs when he went. So he contracted it while gone. We could then make some level of presumption that he wouldn't have gotten it while he was on the street, perhaps. I wanted to bring up, though, that I watched a movie last night. I think it's called Most Wanted. It was very slow, but it's about some Canadian drug dealing going on, and then somebody ends up in a jail in Thailand. Dude, you don't want to go to jail in Thailand. This is not, if you think prisons in the United States are bad, this is no joke. They got like just an open, no bed, no floor, not no floor, just like maybe it's a dirt floor and 50 people, and everybody's just in leg irons. No separation, no personal property, nothing. So I just wanted to bring that up, that there are certainly worser places to go.
Certainly that is true. People in the Latin American countries, particularly when you live in a border state like mine, you hear people that have been in jail in Mexico and various Latin American countries, and they don't yearn to be in jail in the United States, but they're able to recognize that an American jail is preferable to almost any Latin American jail. And again, nobody wants to be there, but when you do the comparison, it's all relative when you're type of places that people get incarcerated in around the world, which are medieval dungeons in many instances.
Yeah, this was not cool. All right, but then over at mynewsla.com, sex offenders lose bid to serve on juries. Judge rules all ex-felons don't have to be treated the same. I never like when sentences are worded sort of like in a negative context, and that's one of those ones where it's they don't want to not be, and it makes my head kind of hurt. But so I guess some of our people, some PFRs, wanted to serve on juries, and it didn't go well for them in court?
I wasn't able to find how to access the judge's decision, but from the article here, it didn't go well. And of course, there's always appellate options, but it didn't go well.
Why? Can you even just get into the judge's brain for a minute? Why wouldn't all ex-felons be treated the same?
Well, because the law mandated a different treatment, that's why.
Oh, so in the law, then it would say that these people can't serve on juries ever?
Well, I'm suspecting that, like I said, without being able to read the decision, but I'm guessing that when they passed this, that restored the right to serve on juries, there's always carve-outs for people, for the PFRs, for the persons forced to register. And I'm guessing that was the carve-out that they had to make as a compromise so that anybody could serve on a jury. And the basis for the lawsuit was probably there's an equal protection clause in the United States Constitution. So the argument would have been that therefore the all ex-felons should be treated the same. And this is the Superior Court judge saying, nope, the legislature mandated a separate equal treatment. But like I say, with the opinion, I could be more precise, but
yeah, sure.
All we have is an article here.
And it does say, like in the middle of the article, it says, however, the bill was later amended to target registrants by making them the sole class of persons excluded from that bill's reforms. So I guess they did make a bill that allowed felons to serve on juries, but in the bill they said negative Ghost Rider.
Yep, and that's, I mean, it's the will of the people as expressed through their legislative elected officials that we're going to restore everyone's right except for And the people could have said, no, we want everyone, but they didn't. They said, we want everyone but.
And I'm gonna hit you with this little softball. And laws are presumed to be constitutional?
They are, until the challenging party shows by the clearest of proof that they're not.
Clearest of proof. All right. So there is a non-victory for our people. But that probably was something that was kind of sort of doomed to fail from the start.
I don't know. I'd have to look at it and see if each side would have cited case law that they thought supported their position. And this is a trial court level judge, so an appeal may be launched. And if depending on what the appellate court says in California, this battle may not be over yet. But the benefit of the doubt goes to the law, because as the will was expressed to the people that they didn't want fully to restore people's right to serve on a jury, they did do a carve out. So the question is, can the people carve out what rights they're restoring? If you have the right to vote and you have the right to serve on a jury, now see, I'm not sure that there's such a right. The voting is pretty much a right, and I've always wondered how we could permanently disenfranchise people. But if there's any such right to serve on a jury, then there may be some hope for an appeal on that issue.
All right. Over at Ars Technica, Ajit Pai, who is the FCC chair, urges states to cap prison phone rates after he helped kill the FCC caps. Wait a minute. Ajit Pai helped kill the FCC caps, and now he's asking for them to be sort of reimposed?
Well, I think this is a time to play Governor Maddox, because the phone calls that, my understanding is, and this is not an area of expertise, but my understanding is, once they cross state lines, only the feds can regulate them. And so the FCC, after Obama left office, with the help of the business interests that provide phone services, challenged that limitation that the Obama FCC had put in place on the cost of phone calls, and they won. So I think it's a little bit of hypocrisy here to come back and say the states can do something. I'm not even sure that they have the power to do on interstate calls. Clearly, calls that originate and terminate within a state, the state regulators have control over those. But I'm not sure that the states can do anything about calls that originating from outside their borders in terms of capping those prices.
For you to come back and call bigots my admirers is a farce. It's an act of hypocrisy. It's a terrible way to treat a guest on your show, and you know it.
So as I understand it, and I was following this pretty close at the time, so roughly in 2013, the FCC chair instituted something that put some kind of caps on the cost of phone calls, that for me personally, calls went from about $25 a call out of state to four-ish, maybe $5 a call, which was a huge boon, but I was released very shortly after everything actually kicked in, so it really didn't ever impact me. And then we change administrations a few years later, and that immediately goes away and calls, as far as state-to-state calls, probably go back to 25 or something bucks. I guess that would vary by state. And the reason why this happened is because the current administration appointed this Ajit Pai, who is a former big telecom company lobbyist or executive. I forget which one he was. So it just seems like, hey, I don't want this to happen. Oh, wait, now I don't want this to happen because of the COVIDs.
Well, like I say, I don't believe that the power exists for the states to regulate that. And it was the business interest that challenged the regulation. But the FCC could have continued to defend the regulation in court rather than saying we concede that this is not something that we want to continue with this regulation. And so I think it is a little bit hypocritical now for him to be claiming that he wants something done when he could have and still could lead the charge at the Federal Communications Commission to limit what these companies are charging. But on the other hand, if you're a pure capitalist and you believe that companies who invest their money and who take in business risk, don't you believe that the market should dictate the price? I mean, that's kind of what capitalism is about. I'm just being devil's advocate here.
Yeah, except for it's not like you can go to the other phone on the other side of the dorm and have lower rates. So, I mean, you know, you're totally locked into the prison industrial complex, as you like to call it. There's no alternative other than to not make a call or suitcase a cell phone into the joint.
But wouldn't the prison obviously make the decision to award the contract to the lowest bidder? They wouldn't have an incentive to do anything to the contrary. Would they, Andy?
Since they collect, 50% of the revenue, wouldn't they be incentivized to get the highest cost?
Of course they would. I'm being very, very facetious here. But those who believe in pure capitalism, who claim that there should never be any regulatory oversight, we can cite example after example after example of this is where the big bad government has to be the oversight, because there's businesses where there really can't be a true competition, and this is one. You're not going to be able to have true competition in correctional settings when you're trying to monitor for security reasons and legitimate security reasons. You're trying to monitor what's going on in the way of communications. So you're not going to have a true competition. It's kind of like the electric company. We've tried to have competition and power, but in reality, there's only one distribution. There's only one distribution of power unless you self-distribute the power lines. Somebody has to own the distribution.
And then our final article is going to be sex offenders can find hope in Christ, but not necessarily a place at church. I just wanted to point out more hypocrisy that churches will often be places where they are trying so very hard to help people getting out of prison with maybe clothing or maybe some places to stay. But when it comes to our people, that they are very often, they are turning up their noses at the PFRs. And it's very, very sad, but I just wanted to highlight the article that came across my way.
Well, I find that having worked sort of in the church environment for some number of years, I find that sad. But as society has changed, churches have become a business, and they have to run them like a business, because the liability issues that their insurers are telling them that they face if they have too many people with this background, and they know that they're there, and then something happens. The churches, even that want to be more spiritual, what is it, ministering to the spiritual needs of people forced to register, they find themselves in a conundrum. And there are some who just flat out don't want to. They don't want those yucky people, as they would consider them. But there are churches who really are torn between the ministry and the business side of it, of the liability that their insurance has told them that you have. And they end up in this predicament. And I don't know what the answer is, because the big bad government shouldn't be telling people who to have in their sanctuaries, but the big bad government should not be prohibiting people from being in their sanctuaries either. And we have that component where people are not allowed to go to churches who would welcome them because they're within 1,000 feet or whatever the exclusion zone may be, or they have a daycare, which the government says that qualifies as a daycare, therefore you can't be there, or that's a place where children congregate, therefore you can't be there. So it's a multifaceted problem. The church is a part of the problem. The church could also be a part of the solution in terms of the governmental restrictions, because I'd like to see the church fight back and say that's our business, who's in our doors, not yours.
There's about three paragraphs in. It says, pastors and staff are trained to pay attention to new faces. During one Sunday gathering before the pandemic, they noticed a visitor intently watching children in the congregation. They met him, learned his name, and later found him listed on the sex offender registry. His Facebook page also turned up unsettling posts about children. Could they have picked the worst kind of person to profile, that 90, 95, 99% of the PFRs are probably just trying to get on with their lives and find a place where they can do the worshiping how that they would want to, and they've decided to highlight the worst of the worst kind of person that this could be related to? I don't think that's really fair. That's cherry picking.
Well, it is, and that would be where probably the author of the story should be. Why don't you report about the thousands of people who worship, who do not stalk children or have any desire to do that? But this is the angle the reporter took.
Yeah, no kidding. It is time for a question about the nuances of transferring supervision to a new state. So this comes from, I don't even have a name of a person, how we're going to cover this. How did we?
I could give you. Well, this was written to an arsenal for a Legal Corner submission, and I liked it so much I selected it. It's going to run in the next issue of the Narsil newsletter.
Oh, okay.
And I feel like that this could be a big help to people out there, because I think we've talked about interstate transfer at least twice in the history of the podcast. But we have new listeners, and we have people who forgot or didn't completely understand it. So we can try to unpack it again in terms of interstate transfer. But yeah, this came from someone that submitted this question to us, and I loved it. So therefore, he won himself a free subscription to the newsletter. And we don't put names. We just say an inmate wrote this, but he gets a subscription for putting a good letter together that impacts more than just his situation. And that's the same thing Justin did. Justin asked a question that impacts him, but it also impacts anybody who has a Wisconsin conviction, who might have left Wisconsin. And it impacts anybody who might would want to be relieved of registration obligations. And it impacts anyone who might be traveling. So that's the type of thing that we like to give general responses to, because it's not unique to your situation, that it only impacts you.
All right. So transferring, I'll throw the first one out there, that what organization controls how you get transferred from state to state while you're under supervision?
Well, if you say organization, I don't know if there's an organization, but there's a process. There's an agreement among the states. It's called the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. And there's a process prescribed, which the states have agreed upon, that controls those transfers and those movements.
All right. And so it's just an agreement. And so then is there an office set up, or at least like a person or persons in the states to handle the tos and froms?
Yes, there is. There's the national office in Kentucky. I forget what city, but there is the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. They do have administrative staff, and there is an office, but they're far removed from the individual transfers. They are just simply the entity that puts together the agreement in a readable form, so that the justice people that are employed in the justice system can understand what to do. So they publish a bench book and the compact rules, and then they have a process where if there's a dispute, believe it or not, sometimes the states disagree about what the compact requires, and a state will do something, deny something, or violate the compact, and the Interstate Compact Commission is the entity. But as far as the movement, each state has a compact administration office. So when you're dealing with a correctional entity in each state, depending on the size of the state, it'd be a very large operation. Or if you're in one of our smaller states like Wyoming, you might not have but a handful of people working interstate compact. But the process really starts with your probation office if you're in the community, or if you're trying to leave a prison correctional facility. And these are all people who've got state convictions. We're not talking anything about federal. These are state convictions. It starts with the offender approaching either their caseworker in prison or they're supervising PO to get the process started to make the application to be transferred to another state. You have no right to go to another state.
All right. Well, that would preempt a question I have later. But so I go to one of those two different or three different people, and I say, can I please have the paperwork that I need to fill out to get transferred?
Well, it's really not any paperwork for you to fill out. They do the bulk of it, since it's a communication between interstate compacts. So the thing's all automated today. Back in the old days, they would actually sit down and type up papers, but now they key it into the computer, into a system called ICOTS, and they submit it to the state, and the process is all done electronically. There's guidelines in the Interstate Compact bench book that tells them what needs to be included in the packet in terms of the offender's plan of supervision, their criminal history, any conditions of supervision that are uniquely imposed on them. They have to understand where the proposed residence is, and then they're allowed 45 days to investigate that request for a transfer and get back to the requesting state. And the requesting state doesn't really control what they're called the sending state, and the state that makes the request has no real control over the state that where the request is submitted. That's called the receiving state. The receiving state will determine if they wish to receive that offender.
So do you have any kind of arbitration? If they deny you, can you appeal?
I have not been able to unearth an offender process for an appeal. And in fact, with our attorney, Ashley, we were not able, with the vast amount of research that she did, to unearth that process. It seems like there should be, but the Interstate Compact is relatively new. When I say relatively new, it's less than 20 years old. And it replaced a much more lax compact agreement that was adopted in 1937 called the Interstate Compact for Probation and Parole, the ICPP. And the ICAOS is relatively new, and there hasn't been a tremendous amount of litigation in terms of what to do. And the courts, they're giving guidance. The courts have been known to duck these things because they said, well, that's all interstate compact. I don't want to deal with that. And so there's just not a lot of case law in terms of what you would do and what rights you have. And that's an area where the case law needs to develop in terms of if they turn you down. But in terms of our audience, on the people forced to register, you can assume that there's going to be a bias against you as a person forced to register.
And why would that be?
I mean, well, I hate to answer a question with a question, but why would you want to take another state's offenders that have committed this type of high-profile offense that has a heightened sense of community outrage, and why would you want that to be a risk on your watch? Wouldn't you rather that Georgia keep their offenders? And if you have 100 offenders from another state that you're supervising and there's a 3% recidivism rate, isn't that pretty much guaranteed you're going to have some offenses that would have occurred in your state that won't occur if you keep those people out?
That seems reasonable. I mean, it's a NIMBY thing, not in my backyard.
That's the reason. I mean, and again, I'm not making this rule up. I'm just, you asked me the question, why would they turn you down? That's why they would turn you down, because of the heightened community sensitivity, and about there will be some reoffense rate, regardless of how low it is. And whatever number of offenders you have that are required to register that you've allowed in from another state, if that recidivism rate is as low as 3%, which is a number we tout around a lot, if you've got 300 offenders from another state there, you've got offenses that are occurring in your state that wouldn't have if those people had not come to your state. Conversely, geologically, you'd want to get rid of just as many as you could that have committed those type of offenses, because you would want, if you can offload 100 of your offenders that have that type of offense, you'd rather them to be offending in another state, wouldn't you? If you really are that afraid of recidivism, wouldn't you want to offload as many as you possibly can? That's what's the fallacy of this letter. Why don't we just read his question? But that's the whole fallacy of this, because it'll illustrate my point better. Let's read his question.
Let me get back to it, because I extracted the questions from it. Did you put it in Dropbox, Larry? You did, right?
Yes. No, I sent it to you by email.
That's
I never
why
put
I
it in Dropbox.
Find
That's
it.
Why you can't find it. Well, what kind of show prep have you done?
Clearly not enough. I read the thing and I extracted out the questions of what I wanted to deal with.
I'll find it, read the question.
I got it.
All right.
So you want me to just go from the start of it?
Yeah, it's a short question. Yeah,
sure. I'm serving time in Tennessee and will be getting out next year and would like to return to my home in Georgia and take care of my aging parents. How can I find out what I need to do if the entire process is cloaked in secrecy? I spoke with my caseworker and did not find the person truly knowledgeable regarding interstate transfers. Does NARSOL have some basic information on interstate transfer of supervision for those in my situation? It is rumored around the prison that I have to pay $150 for the privilege of applying to prison. Is this true?
Yes. In his case, that Tennessee does levy an outgoing application fee, and that's how I wanted to illustrate my point. If you believe recidivism is high, as you say that you believe it is, and you're in the law enforcement apparatus, you would want to get rid of as many as you could. So if you stop and think about it, you'd want to waive that fee, and you'd want to put together the most beautiful application packet you could possibly put together, and you'd want to get those people, you'd want to get him down to Georgia, right? Because he's a risk to the community of Tennessee, so why not have him in Georgia, have him being a risk there? I mean, doesn't that make sense?
Sure.
I mean, it's the exact argument in reverse of why that they don't take people. If you don't want to take people because they're so dangerous, then logically you'd want to get rid of as many as you could as quickly as you could.
Absolutely.
So yes, some states charge an outgoing fee, and they charge that fee for their time in processing your application. And in the answer, I told him that he needs to consult and see if they have an integer process where they can waive that fee in Tennessee. And I don't know if they do. I didn't do that type of research. But some states don't charge, and some states charge a higher fee for one versus the other. Like probation is one fee, and parole like be a different fee. But all that is on the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision's website. There's a link you can follow. And I know prisoners are not going to be easily able to access that. But your family member can follow that link and find out what the fees are, but what state you want to transfer to, and find out, because you could go bankrupt pretty quickly if you're $150 a pop to apply. And you want to make sure that you have done all the homework you can do before you apply, because they may turn you down, and then you've got to start that cycle all over again with a new proposed address.
The question that always perplexes me, Larry, is whose rules do you follow? Do you follow the rules of the sending state, or do you follow the rules of the receiving state?
Well, let's clarify, because that's what seems to be the confusion. Are you talking about rules for supervision or rules for registration?
Yes.
Which one?
We need to cover both, because a person moving is going to have to follow the rules of state A and state B in some combination.
Well, when you're registering, you never follow the rules of the sending state. Your registry is always what the receiving state is.
So hypothetically, our 51st state has no registry at all. You move to that state, you wouldn't have to register.
You wouldn't have to register. That would be correct. Now the question would be, if we had a hypothetical state that didn't have a registry, since we don't, would the sending state allow you to transfer, because its members, it's their option to allow you the privilege of transferring? If I'm looking at that state and we have 50 states and we have two states that don't have a registry, and we hate you so much we want you to suffer the humiliation of registering, would we allow you to apply to that state?
Then I guess the answer to that would be no. God, doesn't that then introduce another element of it being punishment, Larry?
It does. But in terms of your question, if you go from Florida to Vermont,
right?
Vermont tells you to mail us your form once a year after you do your initial registration. And Vermont tells you that we're going to cut you loose after 10 years unless you have multiple offenses. Florida has no say about that in terms of your registration obligation. If they transfer you to Vermont, you're registering in conformance with Vermont's registration requirements. But Florida does have say over the conditions of supervision they impose on you. All of those go with you to Vermont.
And they also have the say of whether they would let you transfer to Vermont. If you went to a state that had some other similar shitty registration scheme, then they would say, yeah, you can go there, but you're not going to Vermont, which is sort of not so bad.
Sort of not so bad. The people in Vermont think it's awful, because that's all that they you relate it to what you know. I mean, we've got a listener in New York that just thinks it's horrible, and people would die to have New York's registration. But in Vermont, that would totally be, the registration would be their obligations. Now, Florida, again, as we talked about earlier, they may not take you off their website, but Florida is out of the loop in terms of your registration. But all the conditions that were imposed on you by either the judge or by the supervising authorities, those go with that packet to you to Vermont. And under the compact, they're obligated to enforce those. And if they cannot enforce those conditions, they're supposed to notify the sending state that we are unable to enforce those restrictions. And then the sending state can either remove them, or they can deny, they can say, well, we withdraw the request, because those conditions have to go. But you do not get an advantage by going to another state. All of your supervision requirements are imposed on you, go with you. If you owe a $5,000 fine, you still owe the $5,000 fine. If you have 10 years of supervision, and Vermont would have only given you 2 years for that offense, you have 10 years of supervision. It doesn't gain you an advantage. To the opposite, it can actually give you a disadvantage. You could have a state that like Vermont, must reverse that transfer, and you want to transfer to Florida because you've got familial support in Florida. So you go from having to register once a year and mail a form in to having to register three times a year. You go from having no exclusion zones in Vermont to having exclusion zones everywhere, as large as 2,500 feet in Miami-Dade County. You go from having I'm guessing, fairly lax supervision in Vermont to possibly having much more extreme supervision in Florida, because Vermont's conditions come with you to Florida. But Florida has the option under the Interstate Compact to take your offense, compare it to what that offense is in their state, and they can impose conditions additionally that they would have imposed had you been convicted in Florida for a similar offense. As long as they're not doing that, those special conditions to dissuade you from coming to Florida, if those are consistent standard conditions they impose on that offender, they can impose those conditions on you in Florida. So you may end up in with, rather than getting a better result, you may end up going from the what is it they say, the frying pan to the pot or whatever that thing goes.
From the pot to the fire to the pot, whatever.
Yeah, don't think of an interstate transfer as some place where you're going to get a better outcome, because that's not the purpose. Interstate transfer is not going to likely result. Now, the reality is, if you go to Vermont and you go from a real bad state like Alabama, where they hate everybody, and the people that run the system have a 11th grade education, and you go to a state like Vermont where they take, if you ended up in Burlington, where they have a little more progressive view of things, you might end up with a supervising officer that just may refuse to enforce some of that stuff, even though it's in the paperwork. How rigorously they're going to enforce that is entirely up to the human individual that's charged with the enforcement. So I can't say that you may end up with a better outcome by transferring, but you don't go into that. You just hope that happens, because there's no assurance that they won't be just as rigorous as the state that imposed those conditions.
So we've already covered the fees, and then let's go back to, is the transfer guaranteed? Are there any conditions that you have, family, kids, your dog, your house, anything that could be, we can't deny the transfer? Or can they just always go, nah, we don't want to?
There are situations, and there again, the bench book is a helpful tool for that, because they have a chart of mandatory acceptance cases. And a couple of examples would be like, if you were living in that state at the time you're convicted and you can prove that would be a mandatory acceptance state. So you're traveling out of state and you do something that causes you to enter the criminal justice system, but you were only in that state as a visitor, and you go back and forth to court and you plead out in that state and then you want to go back home. They will have to take those cases back, because that's a mandatory acceptance case. You can't use the justice system to make someone homeless if you're putting them on probation. Now, if you put them in prison in that state rather than sending them, giving them community supervision, I'm not clear if that breaks the requirement that they take that person back if they were living there at the time of their sentencing. But clearly, if you go straight from being on the street, you go to a plea, judge gives you 5 years probation, you were living in Georgia, you go plead out in Arkansas, Georgia has to grant reporting instructions. But what Georgia doesn't have to do is, if it's a person forced to register, if it's a sexual offense, and that means, or if Arkansas defined it as a sex offense, or if Georgia defines it as a sex offense, which Georgia has a slightly broader list than Arkansas does, if Georgia, either state, defines it as a sex offense, then they will trap you in the sending state until the receiving state has cleared your residence, because you might, if in a normal circumstance, they would give you immediate reporting instructions and say, we verified you, that was your place of residence, you could go straight home. If you have a sex offense, they don't have that provision, that you could end up trapped in the state where you did the plea, because that residence you're going to live may be an exclusion zone. So the attorneys are woefully, woefully underprepared on that. They plead out people all the time, and then their client says, I'm stuck here, and they say, huh? And they say, oh, when I went to probation, they said I couldn't go back until my home approves. And then what's even sadder is that sometimes the home is not approvable, because the people back in Arkansas say, well, sorry, that's within an exclusion zone, can't live there. And the person's been living there 27 years, and they don't have the $100 a night for a hotel room in Georgia, and they end up trapped. And that happens all too often, because defense attorneys out there, you're not prepared. And you don't take the time to be prepared. You tell them, I got your probation outcome. All you're going to get is probation. This is a sweetheart deal. And you have not bothered to know what the consequences are to pleading out to a sex offense and how that's going to impact their life when they leave that courthouse. You haven't done your homework, and you should do your homework.
And who would be the expert on the subject?
Well, I don't know who all of them would be, but I know that I do teach this in our state, and I really hammer that issue. Every chance I get, because attorneys just don't know. And probation sounds so good, particularly when, yeah, you know, when you've got something that could easily end the person with a prison sentence, and they're not intentionally doing that, but they're doing it by omission. And if you're going to do sex offense cases, you need to know what the registry is all about, and you need to know the consequences, and you need to properly inform your client, because your client might not have taken that plea if you had told him, and by the way, I'm telling you, this is a great plea, but one thing that I haven't told you we need to talk about is what are you going to do for housing, because they have up to 45 days to investigate your place. Yes. And do you have 45 days worth of income to keep you going, or do you have anybody you can stay with? Because I can try to stall for more time if you can get that money together, but that's going to be the inevitable outcome, is you're going to be trapped in this state because this is an offense that's going to require registration, and we've got to make sure that you can live. Now, preferably, you would do that research and make sure that you know whether that residence is going to qualify, but that can be more difficult because then you're getting into another state's restrictions, and who do you call? How do you get accurate information? And you end up just like the person calling around. I know people that spend their life calling around other states, and they say, gee, I can't get any answers. Well, that's true. You can't.
Right. And then the final question that I have is, how long after I arrive at the destination state do I have before I am required to register?
Well, that would be up to the destination state. It would be whatever amount of time that they have. Now, your state's going to tell you to register within a certain amount of time. But in reality, they're not going to violate you as long as you get registered within that state. Because for them to violate you, they're going to have to allege to the sentencing court that you violated the law in the receiving state. And as long as you complied with that law in the receiving state, you've got whatever amount of the time is, which is typically 3 days, sometimes as many as 5 days, or even in our state, it can be as long as 10 days before you have to register. But I would tell people, you know, don't drag it out. Register within a couple of days. That way you're showing good faith to be in compliance.
Sure. Is there anything else that we've missed?
Well, I'm sure that the listeners will let us know, but I really think that this is an important thing about interstate transfer, and people out there who may be contemplating it, write us. Sorry to say call us. Nobody calls. When's the last time we got a phone call? Wasn't it about 3 months ago?
Close to it.
Write us, and we may can engage on that particular point, as long as it's not too personalized to your case and the nuances of your case. But like this, is very general. He wants to know how to get to Georgia. Well, the answer is very simple. He needs to do a lot of research, find out what restrictions he's going to have, and there's nobody he can call easily. There's not somebody sitting in Georgia waiting to say, oh, you're in Tennessee prison? We'd just be delighted to have you here in Georgia. Now, how can we be of help?
Right. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. Well, to continue on with the show, and Larry, you even wrote me up like a cheat sheet for this Commonwealth thing. Commonwealth of Pennsylvania challenge in Montgomery County, common pleas, blah, blah, blah.
This is one of the 5 appeals that have been working this way. We talked about I don't know how to pronounce it, but we talked about a case recently.
Torsarelli, I think. It's about a month ago.
Yeah, we talked about that. And this is another one of those cases that's working its way, had worked its way at the state Supreme Court. This is Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus Claude Lakem and Michael Whitmayer.
Okay, and what? So, God, Larry, you wrote me up the cheat sheet, and I read the cheat sheet, and it still comes out to be like legalese. They were trying to get some relief of some sort for, I think their crimes were like 1 million years ago, and they were, things changed after their crimes. Is that sort of right?
Sort of. Yes, this is a consolidated appeal. from both Lakeham and Whitmire, and the essence of it is that the registry and the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania decided, I believe, in 2018 in Munez or Muniz, however they pronounce it, that the registry was unconstitutional because it imposed punishment retroactively the way they increased the duration and all the requirements when they passed their law in 2010, which took effect, I believe, in 2012, December 20th. And after years of litigation, they decided that. Well, then the legislature needed to fix that because, I don't want to say the terminology I use, but they're just not going to let thousands of people disappear into the wind. So they, okay. Like something in the wind, you know, you've heard me say it before.
They're just not going to do that. Usually it's doing like number one into the wind.
And so therefore, the General Assembly passed an attempt to save the registry for people whose crimes predated, and these two, both Lakeham and Whitmire, did predate December 20th, 2012. So they came up with a subchapter in their revised attempt to be constitutional, subchapter I. And that in the cheat sheet, subchapter I applies to those convicted of a sexually violent offense on or after April 22nd, 1996, but before December 20th, 2012. So that's what they did. And they peeled back some of the onion from what had been in SORNA, which was what had been declared unconstitutional as applied to people who had been roped into it retroactively. So this is a universe of people whose crimes predate SORNA. Okay. When I'm saying SORNA, I'm talking about the 2012. They didn't call it SORNA until 2012. They called it Megan's Law.
Okay.
But when they adopted the Adam Walsh Act, they referred to that as SORNA because of the federal lingo, the jargon, they referred to it as SORNA. But as I have said so many times, and every time I say it, I get a hate mail. Registration of any type, whether it be sex offenders or whether it be people exposed to bad water in Flint, Michigan, children, or whether it be young men for the draft, whether it be whatever, in and of itself isn't unconstitutional. Each version of registration has to be examined on the merits of it. The courts will never be able to issue a decision to say that you cannot register people under any circumstances because that would knock down hundreds of registration schemes that we have operating constitutionally. I've sent an email to someone on a task force. We're looking at how to respond about a police officer's registry. A police officer's registry doesn't have to be punitive. It could be punitive, but it doesn't have to be punitive. You could register the police officers. You could keep their information confidential, except for those who have a need to know. You could allow the police officer to go about his or her life, the former police officer that engaged in misconduct. You could allow them to work in any other occupation other than police business. And you could only make that information available to anyone who would be considering hiring them for police or security type work. And that would be a form of occupational debarment for one occupation, unlike the sex offender registry, which in many states debars the person from so many occupations because of either the proximity restriction or this flat out, they have a list of things that a person can't do, from driving an ice cream truck to a taxi cab to an Uber and to on and on and on. They can't work in a place that serves children primarily, but you can do that. And that's what we have here. The Pennsylvania legislature said, we're going to try to see what we need to do to have a constitutional registry. So they passed subchapter I and they peeled back the onion and they took off some of the previous things that had concerned the court in Munez. And in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, this was not unanticipated because they relaxed it not as much as I would like to have seen, but they relaxed it just enough to satisfy the majority of the court. And that's what they did. And at this point, what they did, and we can go through what I think was most relevant. They did put forth a specious argument that said that one of the parties didn't have jurisdiction. The court wouldn't have jurisdiction because he didn't use the Post-Conviction Relief Act, which is the primary way to challenge something in Pennsylvania. And there's a time limitation, and the court just laughed at that, and they said, nope, we don't require that you use the PCRA. So that's a specious bogus argument. So they got slapped down on point one. But point two, of those Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez seven factors, which they only look at five of them, the one that I think played the integral, most important part was the disabilities of restraint, which those who know me have heard me ranting about this for years. You can have a registry as long as it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints. And they decided that this peelback of what they took off of the requirements was just enough. They don't consider it a disability or restraint. I still consider having to go to a police station once a year to be a disability or restraint. But when they compared what they were having to do previously, which they go through in the opinion, if anybody wants to read all 60 pages, including the dissenting opinion, they went through what has been peeled out of the onion, and they peeled back the in-person in terms of when you change employment or have any updating information under the version of SORNA that applies to people convicted after 2012, they make any change, they have to go in person. They peeled that part off of the people who have old convictions. They peeled back the terms of registration to be what they were at the time you were convicted, which in most instances is going to be 10 years. Okay. And they peeled back the onion just enough that if you go back to your original term of registration, you don't have to go in person. And they say that they don't see this as being particularly disabling to have to. And they say once a year in person is necessary to keep your photo current. Now, what they don't tell you is that you could actually take a photo without going in. And through electronic transmission and with the facial recognition, they could quickly identify if that's you, and you wouldn't have to go in at all. But that's not what the legislature chose to do. The legislature chose, rather than using technology, they chose to require a once-a-year in-person visit. And everything else can be submitted in writing.
Yeah, and it says that they were required to register quarterly, so now they're only required to register annually.
And the big thing they did is they put a removal process in for the, there were a few people under the old Megan's Law that were lifetime by virtue of their SVP, their sexually violent predator designation, or for having multiple convictions. You could be a lifetime offender, but most people were not. But those people that are triggered under the old law, which essentially those terms were restored by subchapter I, those people now can petition to be removed. And so that interjects due process into it. Now, they have to show by preponderance of the evidence that they're not a threat. But there's a petition process now, and this is just enough to be constitutional. And this is the final say on this. There's nowhere else to appeal to. I mean, you could file a cert petition with the Supreme Court. Lakeham and Whitmire could do that. They're not going to grant it. They've already told us that when they denied the cert petition and Munez, that they have no interest in this Pennsylvania issue, and they're not going to grant cert on this one. And I doubt that even the attorneys would even bother to apply for cert. But this is the end of the line. So this is a registry that will be applied going forward to people who have old convictions, and the court has spoken. So the only other way to change it is through the legislative process, and that's not likely to happen because why would they change it now? The courts have ratified this as being just enough of a peelback.
Does this by chance set up a framework of what other states could do to be constitutional? Like have they found the wall, like what the limit is of what is or isn't constitutional?
Well, they have in Pennsylvania because each state Supreme Court is different. I mean, other state Supreme Courts will look at this if this issue comes before them where they're trying to figure out if they peeled back enough. They will certainly use this well-written analysis. They'll look at that, but it doesn't. There was a dissenting judge with a very blistering dissent. I don't pay much attention to dissents because at the Supreme Court level, they don't mean a whole lot. But since someone said, Larry, you should talk about the dissent, so I'm talking about the dissent. There's a well-written dissent that's in, I've got two versions in Dropbox. One is the one that Pennsylvania Parcel sent us, and it only has the majority opinion. But then I went on Casemaker and downloaded the full with the dissenting opinion, and I made some highlights in both. But those who like to read dissents, have at it. There's a well-written dissent. So I guess if you could change the makeup of the state Supreme Court enough to where more people thought like the dissent did, you could come up with a different outcome. But right now, I don't see that happening anytime soon.
And that would take a massive effort, because I know how the SCOTUS is identified, you know, lifetime appointments, and I don't know how the states are, but I'll assume it's something vaguely similar, that it would be pretty hard to change enough of them to make a difference down the line.
I don't think it's lifetime, but it's sometimes it's very political, where they just run for the seats, and sometimes it's a hybrid model where they're appointed, then they have to be retained in a retention process, and I don't know the Pennsylvania process, but I know that in Wisconsin, it's elected because they were able to get one of the real right wingers off the court in the last election, and so that's one step towards getting. I would dare say, and I don't know this judge, but I would dare say this judge is probably not a real conservative judge that wrote the dissent. But anybody who wants to read the dissent, do the research on the judge, and if it comes back that this is a real conservative judge, we'll certainly put your comments on, and if you can document it, don't just say, in my opinion, this is a conservative, but show us that this person is recognized as a solid conservative. And if that's a dissenting judge, we'll say that next week, or whatever amount of time it takes you to put that together. But usually the dissent is not from the conservatives on this issue. They're usually okay with it. So I'm doubting that's the case.
Can you do me one favor? You talked about, I don't remember you saying it during the segment, but we talked about it pre-show, and I said that sounds like a strict liability, and you used some word that I'd never heard before. Can you use that word again? It was one of the seven thingamajiggers for the Mendoza-Martinez thing.
Yes, it's S as in Steve, C-I-E-N-T-E-R, Sienter.
Sienter. And what is Sienter? Can you define it in so many terms?
Knowledge.
So strict liability means you knew the crime you were committing was committing the crime.
No, just the opposite. It means you didn't know, nor do we care. It's a strict liability crime.
Okay.
So, the Supreme Court of the United States has expressed a strong distaste for strict liability of crimes, and they have said that they're okay in regulatory type situations, or crimes that are very minor that don't carry life-altering consequences. And one of the factors is to help determine if this is a civil regulatory scheme, because in civil regulatory schemes, oftentimes we don't really care much about whether you do any better. You know, you just shouldn't do it, and you get slapped on the wrist for doing it. But in registration, too many courts ignore that seven, and it would be easily adaptable to what would help you come up with another factor that weighs in favor of finding it's punitive. In order to be required to register, I do not know of any state where you can be required to register and not know about it. You have to be apprised, and since Padilla versus Kentucky, U.S. Supreme Court, the collateral consequences, all that are known at the time, you have to be apprised of those. And one of the collateral consequences of a sexual offense conviction that triggers a duty to register is that you be informed. So you have to know that you have a duty to register. So that means in order for this scheme to come into play, there has to be a finding of scienter. You do not have to register until you know you have to register. And if you've never been apprised of a duty to register, they can't convict you of failing to register. So in my mind,
some sort of crime in 1910, and you've never even heard of the registry. Here you are 120 years old, and they'd say, well, you didn't register. We're going to throw you in prison for the rest of your life. Like, well, shit, I didn't know. I got convicted way back when.
And that would be actually, I mean, you're actually being silly, but that's a good point, because in the Adam Walsh Act criteria from the federal government, there is a provision that says that if a person reenters the justice system for an older conviction that didn't trigger a duty, and they get convicted of something that carries a year or more of incarceration, the state can bring them in retroactively. But again, say you got convicted of something that was a felony level, which most felony offenses carry a potential penalty of more than a year. Now, it doesn't have to be imposed. Everybody gets, I didn't get it. I got probation. But your crime had a statutory maximum penalty that was more than a year. Whether or not it's imposed is irrelevant. If you get convicted of a crime that carries more than a year, then the Adam Walsh Act says recapture these people. But if you had a true Tier 3 offense, meaning something that would qualify as a Tier 3, the feds tell you that you can capture them if they're still alive. You can impose a registration obligation. But that person would not have a registration obligation that they could be prosecuted for because they never knew. So they committed their crime in 1972, and they've been crime-free until 2020. And they commit a crime, get convicted, and that state has that provision. They've adopted that recommendation from the feds, and they've got that clawback provision in there. They would have to serve that person a notice. Look, you are now subject to registration. And it would only be after they failed to register, thus they would have had been, they would have the scienter that they need. But they just simply say, we finally stumbled across you. You got convicted in 1975. Therefore, you have to register today. You didn't register. That would be strict liability. That couldn't happen because you have to have knowledge that you have a duty to register.
Fan-frickin-tastic. Okay. I think this is to me, Larry, this is pretty, to me, it's very nuanced, very complicated, very like in the weeds detailed, and it hurts my head. And I think it's simple, but just the way that it's presented is not. And I just want to say it that way, I think.
So, well,
but
I try to present it simple.
I know you do. I know you do. And probably people listening are way smarter than me. And they're like, psh, Andy's an idiot and he'll like, don't worry about it. We got no problem. Man, you guys are smarter than me. That's fine. I don't care. All right. Are we ready to move on then?
I think we are.
Okay, cool. Well, we have... See, I was going to play a voicemail message, but I persuaded the individual with the question to actually ask it and have a little bit of dialogue with you, because you always have follow-up questions of the person that has asked a question. And so this is a patron who has a question to ask you, Larry.
Hi, guys. I do appreciate all that you guys do and getting the information out there. So please keep it up.
Cool. Who are
my
you?
I'm Tammy. And
okay.
My husband is on the registry. I just have a follow-up question from episode 135, the petition for removal from the registry of the podcast. I want to help him with the process of getting off the registry. This will not only benefit him, it will benefit his family too. What actions can me and the family do to ensure a positive outcome? Basically, add to the judge's file, maybe a letter from the family. Would this benefit? What type of wording should be included in those letters? For example, I was thinking that we have a son, and for him to get off the registry would take the fear and anxiety away of any retaliation or being harmed with his name being public. Is there anything else the family can do to ensure him getting off the registry? Thank you.
That's a brilliant question, and it brings forth something I've never thought about. We don't have a petition process in our state, so I'm only involved in an advisory capacity to states where lawyers have met me in some national setting, and they say, what would you do? What would you do? And I never thought about that. But I can tell you that anything a family can do, either legislatively, and I've encouraged this for family members that are old enough to come talk about the adverse impact on the registry to them, it's very powerful when they do it. And I can't imagine that it would be anything other than helpful to have a letter to the judge. Now, you don't get to ex parte the judge, meaning single party communication. So if a petition's filed and the prosecuting attorney is the district attorney is the responding party, any communication to the judge gets presented to the other side, and so they'll be aware of it. And it is possible that the judge would not consider it if the prosecutor strenuously objected. But remember, prosecutors are elected individuals, and if a letter was composed in a way that it sounded like it was coming from someone who was a victim, so to speak, of the horrors of the registry, I would be doubtful a prosecutor would object strenuously. The question becomes, in a removal process, what is relevant evidence? the judge has got the idea by the statute of what's relevant, and then the judge has a little bit of leeway of what they want to consider, and they'll consider things as long as there's not an extremely vigorous objection. So I can't imagine that a letter from a family member would be strenuously objected to unless they really didn't want that person off the registry and they were looking for anything they can do. But in terms of other things you can do, you can make sure that the lawyer is competent. You can make sure the lawyer understands these things. Well, lawyer competency is a real big problem in this area because I'm going to get myself where I don't have any business at all. But lawyer competency and diligence is a big part of the problem. They do not go into these taking this as seriously as it should be taken because of the limitation on how many times you can go back and ask and what the time delay is before you can ask again. You need to get it right the first time. And I think letters, although I never thought of it, I think it's a great idea. And I think most judges would consider it, and I doubt prosecutors would vigorously object. But getting that packet, like Paul Dubling, who's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he does a lot of work for NARSL. He has an extremely good process of putting together the packet, and he gives the judge everything they need to grant the relief that's requested, and he's well prepared. And when you find an attorney like Paul, you have a much greater chance for success, and that attorney has communicated with the prosecution to find out what their position is going to be and how to try to overcome any objection they may have. And if you don't talk to the prosecution, you're never going to know. If you just file the petition and say, well, we'll see when we get to court what the judge decides, you've just cut your odds down considerably when you do that.
Okay, so when you do submit that letter, you suggested to victimize it, what the registry is doing to his family if he stays on.
That's exactly what I would say. Just like when we ask people to come to legislature, we want that teenager to say, until my father was on the registry, I had a good social life. But now he's on the registry, the kids won't have anything to do with me. I'm an outcast. And I didn't do anything wrong. This is the consequence of what I'm having. And I didn't do anything wrong. And I'm a victim here. And the age old kids, you say, I didn't ask to be born. I said that in my life at once or twice. I'm sure most of us have. The kids didn't ask for this. So you can't help but be moved by, if you're human, you can't help but be moved by a minor who's saying that I'm suffering because of this and I'm being victimized because of this. And my father, my mother, whichever the case may be, is an exemplary parent, and I need them in my life. I can't see how that would be anything other than helpful.
Okay. Great. Can you think Fantastic. Of anything else?
No, but I'd be glad to help you. If you know how to contact us through the channels, I'd be glad to try to help you when that time comes.
Is there a kitty that you can like start throwing dollar bills in or $100 bills into the judge's coffers? I mean, does that help? I don't know. I've never heard of grabbing straws.
I've never heard of that. I keep emphasizing that the prosecution is the bigger part of the picture than the judge. You're going to occasionally run across a judge that just hates anybody who's got this type of conviction. But judges are human beings, and if a compelling case is made and there's not strenuous opposition, they're inclined to just go. I mean, they want to get through the day and get off the bench. Believe it or not, they don't want to sit there and hear all this stuff. So if you can reduce the prosecution's anxiety, that is so critical to everything, because in every state I'm familiar with, that is the responding party. That is who you have to go through as the district attorney or the prosecutor's office. That's the responding party on the petition.
All right. Well, thank you, Tammy. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Then let me play. So, Larry, I was fortunate to have one of our Patreon supporters. He was rolling through town, and we met for lunch, and he was just leaving one of the horrendous states. And while he was traveling, he was listening to the show for a little while. He's not here now, but definitely need to give a shout out to Nate from Iowa, who was listening. And but he left a voicemail message. It's sort of related. He didn't bring up the actual the hovercraft, but here's a quick little voicemail message from Nate.
Hey, Andy, Larry, this is Nate from Iowa. I'm currently driving to Tennessee looking for Will. I thought we'd try to find him and explain to him what FYP stood for. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know that we just got done going to Florida, and there were no sheriffs or state patrol waiting at the border for us. I think I was only there for about 3 days, so I made it. I'm alive. Anyway, thanks, guys. Can't wait to hear you tonight. FYP.
Well, there you go. No hovercrafts leaving the state of Florida after being there past the requisite time to register.
Well, it surprises me that there was no hovercraft, but you know, I remember we had a recent episode where I said maybe there can be such a thing as a hovercraft because somebody got caught in something. I said, gee, that they really did want to catch that person. I don't remember particulars, but I think maybe there might be a hovercraft.
I just thought it was kind of silly to play. Not encouraging anybody to go break any rules, but just anyway. And also, Will, he's looking for you in Tennessee. He's probably way past there now. He was Nashville or so when we started recording. Good dude. Pleasure to meet you, and thank you for stopping by. We can almost close it out. We got a couple of new patrons this week, Larry. We had a Jay. Jay is a person that emails us all the time, like sends a bunch of articles and finally became a patron. And then also Ethan, who is a person you're interested in having on the podcast in the next, will be on at the beginning of August as well.
Fantastic. So that is a big FYP.
Yeah, man. How about some FYPs? Hey, Tammy, when you were on, you didn't say FYP, I don't think. So might have to cut out your whole section on the question you asked. It's a requirement. But Larry, that's all we got. And where can people find the show?
Very carefully.
Of course it's careful. Where's the website for people to download the podcast?
It's on the internet.
Ah, just somewhere on the internet, the superhighway of informations?
Are you scrolling down the page now? You're scrolling down the page to find it, aren't you? Register 137
episodes and you don't have it memorized. I should be able to wake you up like cold, like, hey, what's the address? And you should just know. And be like, registrymatters.co.
Well, I don't keep track of that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay. Not the important stuff. And so we did get some voicemail messages. And how do people leave some voicemail?
747-227-4477. And if you didn't hear that, it's 747-227-4477. And if you want to send an email, it's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Did I ever tell you about the email address that I originally set up and I lost it? I lost the password to it. I did have registrymatters@gmail.com and I lost it. Did I ever tell you that?
Well, why didn't you do a reset?
I tried and like, hey, what's the most recent password? And I didn't set up enough recovery stuff, so it's just gone. So that's how it's Registry Matters Cast, because I'm an idiot.
So, and then the best way to support us, if you are so inclined, is patreon.com/registrymatters, or just patreon.com, and you can search for all your favorite podcasts, including Registry Matters.
There's only one podcast that matters at Patreon, and that's Registry Matters. That I can assure you. All Larry, right. That is all I have on this fine Saturday night. Anything else before we head out?
I'm done.
All right, man. Well, have a great night, and I will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.
Good night, everybody.